Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Hello and welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio, which comes to you to connect politics and finance, humanity and world peace, and the arts in a way that encourages all to think for themselves so the best political and life choices are made by all. With artistic overtones, the Reasonable Voice is an advocate for a peaceful and prosperous world filled with creativity and political unity. This show, we are talking to Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo. Is that close, the last name?
Adebayo.
And good. Hello, doctor, and thank you for being on the show again.
Thank you for having me.
What we have in a guest here, may I call you Marcia?
Yes, please. Yeah.
What we have in our guest today, Marcia, is a personification of moral courage. There's no other way to put it. Specifically directed at the EPA, as one can find in her book, No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation in the EPA. And we're going to talk mostly about the EPA, but I'd like to ask a couple of questions that might get us there. First of all, EPA started December 1970, is that correct?
Right, and it was an amalgamation, very much like the Department of Homeland Security.
Yes.
Where a number of agents, where a number of people were sort of drafted out of some other agencies and brought together to form this new organization called the Environmental Protection Agency.
And I think people don't remember that. I mean, 1970 to some people seems so long ago.
Yeah, but it is a long time ago. But what's important to realize is that the EPA was sort of, you know, chiseled out of a lot of organizations that had very strong business, sort of business attachments. Like the Department of Agriculture,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
Like the Department of Interior. And so a lot of people, when they think of the EPA, they think of the EPA as an organization where you have like a lot of hippies and a lot of people who are...
tree huggers.
Yeah, tree huggers are what people sort of in their mind think of as environmentalists. But if you really think of the EPA being carved out of organizations that have a very strong commercial
mm-hmm.
Basis, then you really do have a much clearer idea of sort of how the EPA ended up being the way it is right now.
Yes. And I guess it's a good time to mention to everyone, in case they don't know, you worked at EPA for EPA. Can you tell us something about your position and title and duties?
Well, when I first came to EPA, I was the EPA representative to the United Nations, and I had worked at the United Nations, UNDP or UNSL for those that are familiar with those kinds of acronyms. I had worked at the UN for a number of years, and then left the agency, moved back to Washington, D.C., and so the EPA, and then worked for the World Wildlife Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the head of the World Wildlife Fund became head of the EPA, a number of us went to work for him at mm-hmm. at the EPA. And so my job was to work with UN organizations as they developed their environmental agenda. But that was sort of my first position at the EPA.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you at the EPA?
Altogether, I was there for 18 years.
Okay.
And it's been the sort of the defining, I guess, career move in my life, because it was from the EPA that I really began to understand more about how the entire U.S. government works, I think, but in particular this one microism within the EPA, within the government.
Yes. And that's, for all who are wondering, that's exactly why I've asked Marcia to be on the show today. I want to start with something out of Westfield, if you will. West Virginia. We are still in the midst of, a lot of people think, you know, when Julie Roberts made the movie about the water contamination and everything that Erin Brockovich had been accomplished. But the truth is, Erin Brockovich is still out there trying to make that still happen, yes?
Right. And I think, in fact, what's a bit disturbing is that a lot of people believe that, like in the Erin Brockovich case and in several, I think it was called Civil, I think there's another movie about how the EPA sort of comes in on a white horse and solves the problem. But the reality is that the EPA is more likely to side with corporations than they are with local communities. And I'm an internationalist. I work on international issues, mm-hmm. not domestic issues. But from what I could see when I was at the agency was much more prone to support corporations than they were local communities. And that's really where I cut my teeth with the EPA.
And in part, at least, you think, which is why I asked the earlier question of its inception, the EPA inception, in part because they came together, were sort of spawned out of organizations that represented business.
Right, as opposed to organizations that supported public health concerns or supported more humanitarian or environmental concerns. You know, Department of Agriculture for a long time has had a very, I'd say, productive history,
mm-hmm.
Between the pesticides and chemical industries like Dow and, you know, all the other petrochemical companies,
mm-hmm.
And rather than farmers, for example,
yes.
You know, people who are actually on the land, working the land. And so the relationship has always been a very one-sided relationship. Well, EPA, in a sense, was given birth out of that kind of background.
Mm.
And so it just has never, we've never had, I think maybe there's one or two, Bill Riley is one, I think, who came from the World Wildlife Fund, which is where I worked before I went to EPA,
mm-hmm.
who I thought had a genuine interest in environmental protection and had major disputes with the administration over policy.
Mm-hmm.
But to a large extent, as we saw with the Lisa Jackson situation, you know, these political agents, they come to the agency, to a large extent, they take their orders from the chemical companies, from corporations, and when they leave, they're rewarded enormously. So that, for example, when Lisa Jackson left the EPA, she went to work as a vice president for Apple, which is an agency that she regulated.
Wow.
While she was head of the EPA. And if you look at someone like, you can just go down the list and look at someone like Carol Browner. After she left the agency, she went to work for the Aspen Institute, and the head of the Aspen Institute was the person that I sued for discrimination at EPA.
Oh, wow.
All kinds of sweetheart deals are being made that impact the way the agency does its business.
And American citizens and communities and even infrastructure suffers in the meantime.
Enormously. For example, one of the issues that we took on with Lisa Jackson was the issue of air pollution, where, in fact, you know, she was supposedly had a really interesting coalition of corporations that had agreed that we could make some advance in terms of coal burning technologies and could implement some technologies that would reduce pollution from coal mining. The president, I think the EPA scientists signed off on it. A lot of the corporations even signed off on it. When she took it to the White House, President Obama, who floated this by a number of other corporations, said, you know, this is dead in the water. It's not going to happen. Called her to the White House and said, you know, corporations are sort of, you know, not very happy with this proposal.
Mm-hmm.
She basically saluted and stood up, saluted, went back to EPA, said that the air pollution controls were not going to happen, even though we knew at that time that we were going to lose, like, you know, thousands of children from asthma attacks and upper respiratory disease. Nevertheless, corporations were the ones that really won that battle.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, she finished her term, and now she's a vice president at Apple. So there are rewards that are given for playing the game.
Yes.
And unfortunately, it's usually communities that are on the losing side.
Well, that makes it all the more important that books like yours, and indeed interviews like this, take place, because we have seen... even though I've yet to see a perfect politician, but the very fact that President Obama was elected twice, even though he hasn't been that much better on the environment than presidents of other parties or presidents who had preceded him, the fact that he got elected a second time, I think it at least testifies to me that when Americans get information and decide to act on it, they can make change. Now, the next step, of course, is that we've got to get politicians who can stand up to the corporations, because there's a lot of money out there, as you say. It isn't just the EPA administrator; it's members of Congress. They do the bidding while they're in Congress, and then they go off and make three, four times as much doing the same thing. So
right.
We
you
need
see much more than two or three times.
Exactly.
Usually, with the Lisa Jackson situation, she was making what, $200,000 at EPA. Now she's probably making over $1 million.
Yes.
Apple. So, I mean, so the rewards for playing the game, the rewards for being a part of the system are fairly enormous. And what I want to also, what I wanted to, in terms of reaction to your last comment,
yes.
I think most Americans are absolutely terrified of running afoul of the system. The response, the intimidation, the retaliation that one receives for asking questions, for taking leadership, is usually so enormous that most Americans are terrified. And I think it's one of the reasons why Edward Snowden becomes such an important character for all of us to talk about,
mm-hmm.
is because to a large extent his public annihilation or you know, it's just the retaliation that he's faced as a young man, being forced to leave the United States, seek refuge in a different country, is a way for the system to let everyone know,
yes.
that if you dare if you dare speak out about what we're doing, you know, we're going to make a public example of you, and we are going to make sure that no one else will follow in your footsteps. And they've done this on so many occasions, whether it's with, you know, Bradley, Chelsea Manning, or other people, that people are just, I'm not sure if people are acting with free will. I think a lot of people are acting through fear at this point.
I hear you. Okay. I'd like to say, too, as a media person, a film, television, video person, that every time I see not just the movies that are about the real incidents, again, like Aaron Brockovich, but when you see these movie plots, Americans love movies, we see a movie plot, this is always the plot, that the good guy gets pounded from the other side with all of these false accusations to discredit him or her. And, of course, in the movies, American movies anyway, it always ends up, okay, he triumphs. But the reality, the message I think we should take from that is that movies, the old art imitates life. Movies have that redundant, if you will, plot not just to be entertaining, but because that's what's happening in life. And every time it then happens in the field of politics and corporate money, buying politics and changing policy and ignoring the American citizens, I go, don't you remember this from the movie? I mean, and that's why it's in the movies, because this is the way it's done. It's like they have a formula. Is that too much to say?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think most people want to see the right thing happen.
Yes.
But it's just that there's such a disconnect between the political system and the vision that I think most people have of a government that supports them and a government that works on their behalf. So there's this dysfunction going on.
Yes.
And I think in many ways, you know that I'm also involved. I have a production company.
Yes.
No Fear Media Productions.
Yes.
And one of the decisions that I made was that, yeah, I want people to read my book, but I also want them to have a visual notion of what happens in the federal government. So we started a production company, and we're trying to now bring No Fear to not only the stage, but also to the big screen. And so that's what I've been working on after I completed my book. And I think most people want to see the right thing,
Yeah.
So I think in many ways, films are sort of playing into, you know, our hopes and our dreams, our vision of what America is. But that vision oftentimes is very different. You know, my office at EPA was like a little mini NSA in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had intelligence officers in there, unbeknownst to any of us, certainly not me.
Mm-hmm.
We had people from the State Department, from the CIA, who we thought were EPA employees, but in fact were leading double lives. We now know that from the research we've done. But I think that is not the notion that most people think of when they think of an environmental protection agency.
Exactly.
And they don't think of the agency being used to carry out political ends in foreign countries. They think that we're going there to save wells or trees or whatever, when in fact all these agencies are being used as arms of the national security state. And so that's a story that we're trying to tell, I think,
mm-hmm.
is that this is a different America than most people have access to understanding or to seeing. And that's the value of really telling these stories, is to ask Americans to hold a mirror up and say, is this really what you want your government to do?
Exactly.
And I thought it was extraordinary, for example, that even when the government was parading, you know, I mean, these horrific stories on TV about what was happening in Syria, the American public said, no, we're not entering into a new war.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, and when you see the American public rise up, like in the Occupy movement, the civil rights movement, it is a work of art in many ways. Because that's really what democracy looks like, as opposed to the chiseling down of individual privacy and human rights that we are now confronted with.
All right, that I'm going to pause, because that's a great place for us to catch our breath. But we will be right back with Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo. I'm getting it. And we're going to talk more about her book and production company. And I also have another West Virginia question. But the main point I think we've made in this segment is that American citizens have to pay attention. And when they do, they can affect policy. It will never be easy, because there's a money machine running the government, and a corporate money machine. And it's always going to be fighting for its survival, as we must fight for our own. We'll be right back. This is The Reasonable Voice. And in the studio with me today are the technical support creative analyst, catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Opperman and Daniel Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. Stay with us. We'll be right back with author and production person now, No Fear, Marsha Coleman Adebayo.
Wind, water, land, honeymoon, beach, bodies lying in the sand. Wind, water, land. 6 June, beach bodies lying in the sand. intimacy, cool, calm breeze, infantry, fuel, napalm grease, tropical swaying, palm trees, flags waving, honor deceased, Grenada, grenade, pearls for her, Pearl Harbor, parasailing, parachute, paradise, paratroopers, wind in her hair, defending Earth's air, whale watch, dolphins, baby seals, binoculars, Navy SEALs, scuba diving, depth dive, bomb divers, marine life, marines live, submarines, Great Barrier, reef, barricade, aircraft carrier, across the threshold, carry her, wounded soldier, over the shoulder, carrying, wind, water, land, defend, water, land.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices Blog Talk Radio. My guest is Dr. Marcia Coleman
Adebayo.
I've been working on it while we were off air. Marcia, I just want to touch a few things before we get into perhaps a longer conversation, because there's something we haven't mentioned at all I know you want to talk about. But first of all, I have a question about West Virginia. This is not the first time, is it, that the EPA has sort of dropped the ball with coal mining tainted water in West Virginia, is it?
You know, I'm not a domestic specialist.
Yes,
My specialty is international, so I can't, you know, I can't really discuss that as much as I can other issues.
Okay, I realize your expertise is the world. I've just been doing some reading about that, and first of all, of course, the Congress. I understand when members of Congress have to come out and that's where American citizens have to take some responsibility. If you make it necessary for your representative in the House or your senator to come out and say, well, don't blame the coal industry, it's not really the coal industry, and he's got, because you are concerned about your job in the coal industry, which I get, but at some point we all have to step up to the plate and go, wait a minute, our job, destroying the lives of our planet, our children, our grandchildren, you have to find some kind of balance that's better than let's ignore that it's what coal companies are doing to the water supply. But okay.
But you know, that isn't very different from the same struggle that we have in South Africa, which is with vanadium mine workers.
Yes.
And vanadium has some of the same problems in terms of production that coal has. It pollutes the environment, it pollutes the airspace, it pollutes water supplies, it pollutes literally the very earth that the mine depends upon in terms of making profit. And yet you have miners in those plants that depend on their livelihoods depend on working at the mine, even though at the very same time the mine is polluting, you know, the air that their children are breathing and the water that their families are, you know, consuming. And so then the question is, what is the compromise between community values in terms of needing jobs and needing money, and at the same time the profit motive? And, you know, one of the things that we're talking about at this point is the fact that governments have an obligation to provide training for these obsolete industries.
Yes.
And I do consider coal an obsolete industry, even though it plays a major role in terms of energy production in the United States. But it is an obsolete industry because of its detrimental impact on the earth.
Yes.
And so at some point, if we value our existence on this planet, we're going to have to make coal mining obsolete.
Yes.
So the question is, how can we use some of the funds that we're now distributing to Defense Department contractors to retrain coal miners so that we can train them in fields where they can earn a similar living, but at the same time not destroy the earth?
Yes.
And the same is also true with South African mine workers. How do we get governments to understand that you can't have a bipolar environmental policy where you're putting money into mining mining substances that are destroying and poisoning the earth, and at the same time having basically wage slaves.
Exactly.
So that there has to be a defining moment at some point where the government makes, where the people decide that they're going to force the government to retrain them into jobs and provide them with skills so that they can make a living without destroying the earth.
And that is the bottom line. And you know, we say destroying the earth and ignoring the infrastructure and the planet, and we're not tree huggers and all that. But in addition to all of that, I just want to stress, and I know Dr. Marsha knows this, it isn't just the earth we're destroying. We are destroying future generations. We are destroying children right now in what they get from the earth and what they eat, what they breathe, what they drink. So it is a human problem, and if Americans could get their head around that, I just think they have this sort of, these glasses on that show, first of all, it's way off in the future, although that shouldn't be a deterrent, but it isn't the future, it's now. That's number one. And it isn't just the planet, but it's everything, all the people, places and things, animals, whatever, that depend on the planet. We are killing them. And
well, you know, I think Americans are getting a handle on some of this, but they don't quite know where to put their energy.
Yes.
For example, there's a commercial that's running on TV right now that says, you know, 1 in 5 Americans will develop cancer in their lifetime.
Yes.
It's either 1 to 3 to 1 to 5. Well, that is the definition of an epidemic.
Yes.
That is the definition of an epidemic. And so, you know, but I'm not sure that Americans have connected this extremely high cancer rate with the environment.
And that's the connection. That's the bridge we need to get them to make. Because once they make that connection, as I said, when Americans set their mind to it and come out, whether it's to occupy or to vote or whatever, they make things, or to say no to Syria, or even for that matter, no to Iran. We're not, you know, we're not going to fight anymore. But let me get to the subject I've been sort of waiting to ask you.
Sure.
We all mourn, the world mourned the death of Mandela, and we all praised him for all that he went through, and that he did not, punish those who had tortured him, etc. And I'm not here to badmouth Mandela, but I am a little concerned about the American PR of the American government's relationship with Mandela and South Africa. And I'm just wondering specifically about the Gore and Mbeki Commission. What can you educate us about that? How were you involved?
That was the contribution that I wanted to make after former President Mandela died, because I was actually at the table. And I actually saw, and it took me years to quite understand everything that I was witnessing, but I actually saw the United States government's betrayal of the new South African government. And at the time that I was watching and participating in these programs, you know, I knew that something had gone terribly wrong, but I just didn't understand exactly how deep it was and where a lot of the forces that were trying to undermine the Mandela government were coming from. But I saw the South African leadership, particularly in the environmental area that I was working in, really trying to sort of, you know, stand up against U.S. power and stand up against a superpower that was determined to keep the Afrikaners who have been defeated in the streets of South Africa, certainly if not in the boardroom, at bay. And I saw the United States government in the process of making sure that certain leaders were, I think, cast aside, who were raising too many problems about U.S. policy.
Uh-huh.
And also the usage of just money and power to make sure that U.S. and European financial interests were not going to be undermined or changed
because of Mandela's new
South
government.
Africa. Right.
You know,
And so for me, I must say that was very, very, very painful because, you know, I was an anti-apartheid activist and I was excited about supporting the Mandela government. And when I saw that the EPA was trying to undermine this new country, this new birth of a country, for me, it was really more than I could bear. And that was at the point when I began to understand that a U.S. corporation was, in fact, poisoning this community and that we weren't going to do anything about it. That's at the point that I decided that I had to speak up.
Okay. How specific can we get on this? Because this is even though you and I have actually spoken about this before, this is something I think we need to make painfully as specifically clear to all our listeners as possible. Apartheid was defeated. Mandela comes in. It's going to forgive everyone and start a new government, build a new country for everybody. And American corporations, is it fair to make some distinction between American corporate money and American government, or have they gotten in bed so much together that really it's indistinguishable?
I think that there's a very, very, very small area of non-intersection between American business and American government.
Okay.
But the area of non-intersection is so small that I'm not really sure that it's really worth talking about.
Gotcha. I was just hoping there still was one, some little thing in which we can wedge.
There's a small, insignificant area, I think the general calculation, in my mind, is that when you have to make a decision, and, you know, and politics is all about making decisions,
yes,
not just a conversation, but the decision, at the point of decision, the decision overwhelmingly is in favor of corporations.
Yes.
So I think that that's sort of the distinction is between the conversation, the dialogue, and the actual decision-making process.
Well, I agree with you there. I just keep hoping there's a smallest little separation in which the public can drive a wedge, and I'll keep holding on to that hope. But in any case, can you tell us specifically, because I know we have spoken and maybe perhaps off air about this, but there is a mine, a specific mine we're talking about, where the corporations that own it know that it is poisoning the village people, and the American government knows, and this goes beyond political parties and who's in the White House. Tell us, how much can you tell us specifically about what happened and is happening?
No, what I would say, since we're talking about South Africa, I mean, we can narrow in if you want to, and
okay,
just one or two corporations. But, you know, 80% of South Africans, you know, the majority of South Africa's GNP, GDP, comes from the mining sector. And as you've talked about in West Virginia, mining is intrinsically a dirty industry.
Yes.
I mean, you know, we can talk about clean coal like we talk about, you know, dry water.
Yes.
It doesn't make any sense at all.
Yes.
I mean, you know, coal mining is a dirty industry, and regardless of how many filters you put on the pipes, the coal itself, the material itself, is intrinsically, organically a dirty substance for human consumption.
Yes.
For human consumption.
Yes.
And I would argue for water and plants as well. But anyway, the same thing is true in South Africa. So you can imagine a whole economy essentially being run on a mining, within the mining sector.
Yes.
You know, so you have mining in Johannesburg. You have mining. So the country is built around the mining industry. The United States government was concerned because of a very important document called the Freedom Charter, that was written before the Mandela government came to power.
Yes.
Which says that the minerals and the substances beneath the earth belong to the people.
Uh-huh.
And that the banking sector and all the commercial sectors must be turned over to the people. When Mandela walked out of prison, before Mandela walked out of prison, ANC leadership wrote to him and said, do you still confirm your support for the Freedom Charter? Mandela wrote back and said it was inconceivable that he would not support the Freedom Charter.
Mm.
However, after the United States government and Great Britain and other countries, after markets started dropping and countries were talking about pulling out all their industries out of South Africa,
yes,
and there was basically a major economic upheaval, Mbeki, who was obviously the head of the Gore Mbeki Commission,
yes,
issued a statement that he now considers himself a Thatcherite, meaning that he now has connected himself to the economic policies, the conservative economic policies,
uh-huh,
of Margaret Thatcher.
Oh, wow.
So that sent a message to economic markets throughout the world, that the Mandela government, the Mbeki government, was prepared to play ball with the international economic, with global markets.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, then those markets began to calm down in terms of the threats of pulling out, in terms of, you know, higher interest rates and all this sort of thing. So the Mandela government, from the very beginning of the administration, was up against fighting against global capital.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's what the conversation, I think, often sort of trails off in terms of the right and the left. Because the question was how much maneuvering, how much wiggle room did the Nelson Mandela government have at the beginning of its administration?
Exactly.
And so I was at the table, and I was actually seeing the U.S. government in many ways strong arm or put pressure on the Mandela government to go in a certain direction and to ignore the abuses by U.S. corporations in South Africa as a way of just maintaining some kind of peace between the new South Africa and the rest of the world, at least the rest of the capitalist world.
Mm. You know, there's no way to forgive such things. I understand, especially a new president like Mandela. It's not like he had a history of a political power, to come from prison and be handed a country in turmoil and divided and with a history that was acrimonious at least, to try and keep the peace, to try and find balance, to try and compromise. But the reality is, I don't know how much of a choice he had. I don't even know that. You know, with corporate America, we say corporate America, but really American corporations are international corporations. They're American only in name. They are everywhere. You know, they're everywhere, and their goal is to make money. It's not about patriotism, and, you know, they use American patriotism when they need to get something, but it's not about patriotism. And they certainly don't care about what they do, and I know it's a generality, but I mean, American corporations' record in other countries speaks for itself, and the damage that is left just to reap the rewards for themselves is, I think, is pretty clear. So I'm pretty much on safe ground in saying this, but I wonder what. I'm ashamed when the American government is directly involved in this. I expect American corporations to be. I don't know. What is the American citizen supposed to think, how do they respond when they have someone who sat at the table and saw this happen, and then, you know, all the praise and public display for Mandela when he was alive and then when he died, and yet all the while they're pulling the rug from under him.
Well, I mean, you know, and it starts further back, of course, because now we know because of books and memoirs,
yes,
that have come out,
yes,
that it was actually the United States government that that provided the intelligence to the to the apartheid government that led to the arrest of Nelson Mandela.
Yes, back when they were calling him a terrorist, yes.
Back when they were calling him a terrorist, right? And so you're right. It's very confusing for people who are not students of South Africa to put all this together in terms of a government that's, you know, applauding and saying wonderful things about him, particularly at the beginning of the Nelson Mandela government. But in the background, which is what my book is about, but in the background, what they were doing, and I didn't know it until we got to court and until much later when reading legal documents, that behind my back, they were sending one of my colleagues to South Africa to negotiate with the Afrikaners. I had no idea at all. I mean, when I was working with the ANC government, the Mandela government, I thought I was the only U.S. negotiator plotting out a new environmental program for South Africa. And what I learned through the court transcripts and other proceedings is that behind my back, they're sending one of my colleagues. Who I was in the office with every day. He never, you know, so he was clearly a part of that group.
Yes.
And they were sending him behind my back to talk to the whites in South Africa and to figure out how the U.S. government could support the old guard apartheid regime that had just been basically kicked out of power by the people of South Africa. That is a story that really needs to be told. Is this sort of, kids talk about being two-faced. This kind of what I call bipolar American foreign policy is that we have one policy that we sort of lay out, you know, for the masses. But behind the scenes, what we're learning from Snowden and other people is that there's a whole other sort of shadow government in play. That we have absolutely, that there's no accountability. We have no idea what the budget is for a lot of these NSA agencies. We have a secret court now.
Yes.
The FISA court.
Yes.
That, you know, makes secret rulings that most Americans have absolutely no idea what these rulings are about. They misconstrued the Patriot Act so that they could do what they wanted to they could carry out policies that they were interested in pursuing in support of corporations. And so the question is, you know, how do we as a public get a handle on all of this? And then, of course, the president comes out basically, you know, supporting outside of a few little tweaks here and there, and I would just simply call them tweaks and nothing more than tweaks. But outside of tweaking what's going on at the NSA, basically, giving his stamp of approval.
Yes.
So I just think in many ways people are overwhelmed with the, you know, just how large this problem is, and how do you get a handle on programs that our government are involved in that we don't even, they're all being handled behind closed doors.
Exactly.
So most people have no idea what we're doing overseas.
And we're doing a lot, and it's primarily corporate money, but it's supported by, and here's the thing, it's supported by our military, meaning that we are, Congress and presidents are sending the military everywhere. We say we're not imperialistic, but it is an empire to have.
Right.
And the problem mostly for me from a selfish American point of view is that American youth in uniform are often dying to protect the corporate interests of these American-named international corporations who have sunk their hooks into these countries and are benefiting financially and benefiting from the protection of Americans dying on the field of battle, and we call it, you know, serving our country and protecting freedom. That is not what they're dying for.
And what's also very sad is a lot of these young men end up in the army because they can't find jobs.
Exactly.
Right? And then they end up going to countries or serving through the military, and they're supporting corporations that will not hire them when they come back to the United States.
Exactly. We're going to have to stop but give us some hope. Tell us about how we can see your movie and find your book. At least if we get the information, even if it's only a chapter at a time. As you say, people are overwhelmed, but right. education and information, in my opinion, is the way out.
I think, you know, it's important to read the news very skeptically.
Yes.
And I understand that a lot of Americans, you know, have some skepticism about what's going on, but it's important for us not to accept what we're reading and then for us to really sort of, you know, peel back some of the layers of the onion. So in terms of reading my book, the best place to get it, I think, is at Amazon.com. And you're right, it would be great for people to read the book and then have studies about it and to really understand how the U.S. government operates, not just in terms of what we learn in civics class, but really the mechanisms and this cellular structure
mm-hmm.
of how the government operates. And in terms of the movie, we're working very hard to with some very prominent filmmakers now to actually bring the story to the big screen, and we're also working with a playwright, and so we're hoping that not only will we have something on film, but we'll also have the story on stage
mm-hmm.
In the next couple of years.
Fantastic.
Very promising.
And tell us, you are also available as a speaker, right? I mean, people
yes.
can, how can they get in touch with you to invite you to speak at their events or organizations?
Please contact me at my website, which is No Fear, N-O, F as in Frank, E-A-R, Coalition, C-O-A-L-I-T-I-O-N, No Fear Coalition at AOL.com. And I would be delighted to come out and speak to groups.
Fantastic. We're going to end with our discussion with Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo. Finally got it, I believe, for today. But don't go away. We're going to chat a little more here on the Reasonable Voices Blog Talk Radio. So stay with us. Thank you so very much, Marcia, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Bye now.
Wind, water, land. Defend, water, land. Pina colada, strawberry, tangerine, water. Canteen, ping pong paddle, ping ship battle, resort, a last resort, club med, medic, blood red, cruise ship, cruisers, forever friends, I hope this never ends, never friends, will this ever end, memories, memorial, rest and peace, rest in peace, sunset, sons, vets, splash, play, bombs, away, waves, planes, crash, shore, is earth for, love, war.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices. In the studio with me today, by the way, our technical support, creative catalyst, and the spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins. Happy New Year to everybody, by the way. With Michelle Upperman and Daniel L. Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. Thank you for joining us today, and we're going to talk today about how we are protecting, or if indeed we are protecting, our environment. What about conservation of energy and other alternative energies? Recently we had a show that featured the eighth graders out at Henley Middle School and their wind tower. What do we call it?
Wind power.
Thank you. So we're sort of following through on that theme. I should mention that since the last time we were on the air live, I think, Michelle Upperman and Daniel L. Garner have become officially personal a duet as well. They've been now engaged to be married. And
it's very engaging news.
Yes, it is. And so, well, Bernard, how do we conserve, and are we conserving and protecting, and what is the environment? It isn't just one thing.
Well, I think how a person comes to actually care about the environment is what's most important, because I will say that I didn't used to consider thinking about the environment like a top priority for myself. And then I was listening to a hip-hop CD, And the guy said, you know, he's basically listing off all these things that human beings have done to God's creation. And he said, you know, trashing up your planet. And when I heard that line, I was like, oh, I never even thought about that. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Like kind of thinking of the world as a creative masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
So now when I think of the earth itself as a sort of artwork, it really helps me to want to preserve it. Because I just, you know, like the song where they paved up paradise to put up a parking lot. Yeah. Every time I'm driving down the street, I'm just like, this is ridiculous. Like, we have all of this cement, and then we have these little pieces of grass, and we're like, oh, look what we've done. We preserved it. Like, I'm just juxtaposing creation to what we've created. I'm just like, oh, I think God had it right.
Had it right first time.
So I guess just to me, from an artist standpoint, it helps me to be able to be driven about recycling. I mean, I'm not like a major environmental person, but like I do my best to try to recycle. If I'm at somebody's house and I drink something and I see they don't have recycle, I'll take it in my car. So just everybody's not going to be as passionate as the most passionate environmental person, but I think if you could find that kind of thing that makes you see it, why it's important to what's important to you, will help you to do that.
And some of the things we're talking about conserving, we can all throw out something. We may each have our own special thing. But, you know, water is one, of course. Clean water is a real issue. What is it, the movie, Erin Brockovich? She's still out there, by the way, because the very corporations that were polluting the water and causing cancer in the town where she discovered it years ago now, they're still doing it. It hasn't changed. You know, the complaints go on, the fight goes on. So there's clean water, clean air, how to conserve energy and use it more efficiently. I know there are other things, but Michelle, jump in.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when it comes to environmental conservation and how do we take care of the environment, it makes me think about consumerism. It always does, because the reason why we have so much pollution, or the reason why we have, you know, you hear about like certain dyes being in rivers and whatnot, is because of production. Exactly. You know, producing clothing, mass production has a lot to do with that. You know, when we used to use less plastic, there was less, you know, pollution. Certainly there always has been since the industrial age has been pollution, you know, and we, the EPA does a good job and is trying to do its best to keep at least the United States checked, you know, companies checked. And I mean, certainly there are some countries that don't enforce that or don't stick with those regulations as strictly, you know, such as China, for example. And but I think that, you know, what we can do, and Bernard kind of brought this up, what he has sort of come to an epiphany about, is that we, you know, there are certain things that we can do, but my question is, how do we get out of the loop of buying plastic bottles for our shampoo and all of this? Like, it's so hard to, I mean, I think there are a lot of things I want to do differently, but I go, you know, if you want to be able to still live and not give your whole life to having to change the system, then, you know, it's difficult to know how to bypass purchasing things in plastic wrap or doing this and that. And, you know, for me personally, I'd love to have alternatives for that. I really would. And I'm just wondering if I'm just not looking hard enough, or if they're just not really being made available.
Well, I think, knowing you as I do, I'm sure you're looking hard enough. I think the, and of course, I'm not the only one who answers this question, but the number one thing that you hit is that it is, we have to accept as consumers that we are a large part of the problem.
Yeah.
I say this to everybody, I mean, not that I'm a big proponent for speaking out against corporate crime, against the state and humankind, but the reality is there are no big businesses that do things that don't pay them money. So we still have two very powerful things. We still can vote for people and make it clear what we want them to vote for, and that takes more work than just even in the ballot box. We know that. I'm not naive. But also, the most powerful thing, perhaps at least as powerful as our vote, is what we buy. You know, if you don't buy it, they're not going to make it. They just won't. And my biggest story about that was sometime in the late 70s, there was this big rise in beef prices, and all over America, long before the internet was the big deal, cell phones, any of that stuff, yes, I remember that, those days, housewives, women in particular, who were doing most of the shopping, over the back fences, that's all I can think about, in PTA somewhere, they just stopped buying beef. They bought chicken, they bought alternative things, and within less than a month, the beef prices were rolled back. So you don't have to be President Kennedy to make the steel companies jump. You just have to not buy what they're selling.
Well, Jared Diamond, in his book Collapse, makes a case that civilizations collapse ultimately due to some sort of decision in regard to their environment.
Mm-hmm.
Makes this kind of case study on Easter Island, where Easter Island started cutting down trees to put up those statue faces that we've all seen, and eventually got to the point where, because they were cutting down the trees, there was deforestation, agriculture stopped working, they didn't make... And they eventually got to the point where they actually knew that if they kept cutting down trees, it would destroy their civilization, and yet they kept cutting down trees.
Yeah.
And he makes a case on the Vikings. But on the positive side, he shows in the Japan, when they were doing deforestation, eventually they realized that if they kept doing deforestation, it would destroy their civilization. They made the hard choices they need to make, and they thrived. Very, very, really kind of goes through quite, it's a very interesting book. If you take in more than you put out, eventually what you're taking in is going to run out.
Yes.
And, what you have is you're taking a lot from the environment and giving little back. And you have to create some sort of sustainable process. A non-recycling system must, by definition, eventually destroy that which it is taking its resources from, you know, just because there's finite resources. In regard to environmentalism, honestly, I don't think there's anyone who wants to destroy the environment. I think we can get this sort of... picture in our minds that there are people out there who just don't care or who are almost intentionally destroying the environment. Now, of course, there can be businesses and things like that, but the average citizen, I think, if they went to the car dealership and there was a vehicle there that they could afford, that they could put an alternative energy source in it, and it would get them from point A to point B, and it was actually cheaper than gasoline,
mm-hmm.
every single American would in a heartbeat switch to that.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't they? It would save them money. I mean, right? No one likes going to the gas station and paying $4 for what we pay for. So then a few questions kind of emerge. Well, why is it then that we don't switch?
Mm-hmm.
I think, one, there's some conflicting issues. One, the patent system makes it to where oil companies can have the patents on alternative energies that they then wait to develop until they run out of oil so that they can make full profit, which is problematic. That gets into our need to reform our patent laws and intellectual property rights. But second, once America recently discovered that it might have a big, big, big oil they're saying that America might be exporting more oil than Saudi Arabia by 2020. We got real quiet, and the administration did too, real quiet suddenly about wanting to switch to alternative energy. And, I think America has a tough decision because if it could, now it's kind of positioned to make a whole lot of money off of gasoline and these high pollutant energy sources. So will it make the tough decisions that it has to make, or is it going to continue to drive itself in an unsustainable direction? I think it's a tough choice.
I wish I could remember the exact name of this, but it is, one can find it, I think, from what I'm going to tell you about it. I saw a documentary maybe a year ago or slightly less, where there is a country, perhaps Saudi Arabia, but I'm not sure, but there is a country in the Middle East that is one of the leading oil providers for the world, and they're going green because they know one day there will be no oil.
Mm.
Now, I wish I could tell you it's something like mega... I just can't remember. But I'll get back to you on that on the blog or someplace. But the point is, if that is even remotely true, then we in America are going in the opposite direction. Maybe that's not a good idea. What do you think, Bernard?
Well, I think Dan brings up interesting points because I've heard people make a similar argument. It's like, why is this organic food? we promote health of the body, but yet then the price to buy something that's supposed to be so natural costs more than the, you know, fabricated stuff. And another documentary that I saw, you might still want to check it, called Who Killed the Electric Car?
Oh, yes, I remember that one.
But, you know, playing off the topic of green and green, which green do we really want?
Exactly.
You know, the money green or the actual green? And we normally go for what makes the most money green. But I think the other thing I was thinking about, which is the people's relationship to the environment. And I have a friend, you know, who often gets very gung-ho about the environment, and I understand his passion, and he says, you know, well, if we don't take care of the planet, you know, we won't have a planet for people to live on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a cycle, because if you look at people and where they live and what their environment is,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of a reflection of how they feel about themselves.
Yeah, true.
So it's like, why aren't we taking care of people who live in certain neighborhoods? Like,
mm-hmm.
their neighborhoods did just, you know, it's not like these neighborhoods just evolved from the nature
mm-hmm.
and became like they are. So I think we also have to think about how do we deal with the humanity of people, and that will then change how they impact their environment. Because
mm-hmm.
if you don't feel any self-worth, you're going to throw cans on the ground.
Yeah.
You're going to throw paper.
Yeah.
You're going to...
Good point.
The way you feel within
right.
at some point is going to be expressed outwardly, physically. So one way to remedy the environment is to remedy the internal environment of, you know, the human beings we interact with.
Okay.
So that's true. Good,
yeah,
Michelle.
But think about this whole idea of, like, human nature, and I think about how, you know, this is why it would be difficult, the discussion on how to regulate such a thing or to kind of enforce with law this sort of thing of, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, taking, you know, extra lengths to recycle or extra lengths to be more sustainable. But so I haven't really thought too much on how to regulate that or if it should be. But it's really a hard condition of humans. You
mm-hmm.
know, like, you have to get people to really be willing to
mm-hmm.
take a little bit more time. Time is really the factor, in my opinion, that could really, when people start to realize that things that take time aren't bad or,
mm-hmm.
or like, we don't have time for them,
yeah.
you know, because, like, if you were to want to find a certain place that sold, like, let's just say, bulk items that you could bring a reusable bag to collect rice or
yes.
something, like, to get rice, you have to maybe drive a little further.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a like, microwave mindset world, or, you know, maybe, I don't
yeah.
know if that's just America or if it's the whole world now, via globalization, but, you know, it's kind of this microwave mindset that, you know, says, no, I don't have time for that, you
mm-hmm.
know, or I can't, you know, I really wish I could, I really would love to, but I just don't have time, I can barely do what I'm doing already,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's this kind of stressed, and it's so, I feel like it has deviated from watching crops grow and
sure.
being patient and just really having to, you know, you used to eat what grew.
Yes.
And we still eat what grows, but we were still, like, you know,
but
we all just
so full of chemicals.
Well, that's
and
yeah.
whatever.
Yes.
I don't know when the last time it
maybe
was.
Maybe it's just hologram
dirt,
food. Yeah,
but anyway.
Right. But you know, so I think
yeah.
time is a big ingredient in how this problem could maybe be solve, but that actually probably before time is people's perspective on time
sure.
and how, you know, for Bernard's point is this, you know, this human condition of, you know, having people really be willing to make some changes,
mm-hmm.
Me included, you know, everyone included, because
it's back to your point of consumerism.
Yeah.
We have to be educate ourselves that I think I wrote recently, if you want your children to have a better life and your grandchildren to have a long life, we have got to start doing something now. We've got
right.
to do something different. I mean, it's the same. It's the old adage, if
right.
you know there's a problem, or as you just mentioned, Daniel, and you keep doing the thing that you know caused the problem, well, what... And if we're thinking, if we really have reached a point, and we did, by the way, in the not 2012 election, but the one before, what would that be, 2008, 2009? No, it was 2012. A candidate Ryan went to Florida and went to senior citizens' homes, villages, called the Villages. I used to
mm-hmm.
live down that way. I know exactly where it is. And said to them, don't worry, your Medicare is not going to be affected. It's only going to affect people 55 years and younger. And they all cheered.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, if you're 75,
right.
your children
right.
are 55, aren't they?
Right. Right.
So what is that about? But yet, it happened, and it happened a lot in, I'm pointing out those people because they were on national television, but there were a lot of reaction like that, and I just think we've got to say, okay, wait a minute, how can we do this differently? Because I think if we don't make the change, the environment is going to impose the change on us.
In China, they're investing very heavily in natural gas and are very interested in green energy because they're...
China, did you say?
China,
yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. Because in Beijing, they go outside and they can hardly breathe. Mm-hmm. They've been kind of put where they have to go, oh, we have to fix this.
And it's a good lesson for us because they're trying to do what we did, and they're trying to do faster, and that's why they've got all the pollution.
I mean, the population is so low. Electricity arguably saved the whales, because before then everyone was killing whales
for the oil
things like that. So innovation can save the environment once it produces something that can let us go around our current modes of energy. Some major problems is the lack of innovation and creativity in the system. I think the way that we do patent laws and certain intellectual mm-hmm. property rights have really gotten in the way of saving the environment. Mm-hmm. Because, again, if you got, let's even a greedy entrepreneur who wants to make millions of dollars, and he looks and he says, you know what, I could be a billionaire if I made a car that ran off algae or something.
You know.
Well, that guy's going to save the environment, even though his motives are wrong. But we really structured it to where that's difficult. The other thing I'm going to say is the problem you can have in the current economic system we have is the rarer something becomes, the more valuable it becomes.
Yeah.
So there actually can be an indirect incentive to use up all of the oil and to use up all of the resources use up the environment, because then it becomes more valuable and therefore the products you create from it become more valuable. So it can be almost suicidal.
Yes.
Now that's when you get value from limited resources, but the other value you can create is through innovation and creativity, where you're coming up with new problem solving. And we lean far too much in the direction of value through limited resources mm-hmm. versus value from creativity, and that needs to shift.
Well, we're going to close with this little thought for you. The Nestle, as not the only one, but they've been the one that's been exposed, is trying to buy up the rights to water. I wonder why. This has been The Reasonable Voices, and in the studio with me today are technical support, creative catalyst, and spoken word poet, Mr. Bernard Hankins, with Michelle Opperman and Daniel Garner, the literary duo and philosophical minds who created O.G. Rose. We thank you so very much for joining us today and recommending us to all your friends on and offline. I am Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, and I'm hoping that you will become one of the reasonable voices heard around the world.